So, flying across the Atlantic as Tracy, Michelle, and Nicole work out the choreography, I ask one of our military attachés to call ahead to Ramstein Air Force Base for 3 burkas. 5 hours later, we touch down in Germany and get the full military welcome. General Gregory S. Martin, Commander, United States Air Force Europe, greets each of us as we hit the tarmac. There are phalanxes of airmen, lots of brass, including the commander of the 86th Airlift Wing. He gives me a firm handshake and a warm smile. Mr. Franken, sir, I'm Brigadier General Mark Volchev. Welcome to Germany. Thank you so much for coming. My honor, sir. could I talk to you for a moment? Sure. The general takes me aside and leans in confidentially. Mr. Franken, I understand that you put in a request for 3 burkas. Is that right? Yes, I want to have the Patriots cheerleaders come out as the Taliban cheerleaders. I grin, expecting a laugh. Instead, a pensive nod. Mr. Franken, this is entirely your decision. We certainly don't want to tell you how to do your job, but we are trying to make the point that this is not a war against Islam, and we think that the burqas might send the wrong message to the Muslim world. He's looking me square in the eye. The implication, basically, is that the Taliban cheerleader bit could severely complicate our war against terrorism, perhaps leading to the deaths of thousands of innocent Americans. But it's funny. As a comedian, that's always my immediate reaction. Somehow, though, I can't say, but it's funny to the commander of the 86th Airlift Wing. So, the Taliban cheerleader bit, gone. Still, we had a great time, a whirlwind tour with stops at bases in Sicily, Bosnia, and Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo. It was my 3rd trip in as many years to Kosovo. There's no airstrip at Bondsteel, so each time I went, we'd chopper in on Chinooks from Macedonia, flying over the rugged Sar Mountains, which tens of thousands of ethnic Albanians had traversed to escape the ethnic cleansing that President William Jefferson Clinton finally put an end to. On my first USO tour, as we flew over the Kosovo countryside, we could see below us the burned-out roofs of ethnic Albanian homes that had been torched, right next door to Serb homes with TV antenna on their intact roofs. That was Europe, 1999. After Milosevic had thrown in the towel in June of that year, U.S. peacekeeping forces seized about 1,000 acres of farmland not that far from the Macedonia border. On my first trip to Bondsteel that December, the camp had been under construction. Soldiers slept in wooden barracks and used makeshift latrines. Brown & Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, a company you might have heard of, was the contractor. 2 years later, on my 3rd trip, Bondsteel was looking like a base stateside, with 25 kilometers of roads and over 300 buildings housing nearly 7,000 troops, and there was even a Burger King. I was told that for every burger consumed by a GI at Camp Bondsteel, Brown & Root took a cut, and Dick Cheney received a coupon. It reminded me of an exchange from the 2000 vice presidential debate. Citing the accomplishments of the Clinton-Gore years, Joe Lieberman alluded to Cheney's $20 million send-off from Halliburton. "And I see, Dick, from the newspapers that you're better off than you were 8 years ago," Lieberman said. That got a laugh. But Cheney came back with a topper. "And I can tell you, Joe, that the government had absolutely nothing to do with it." That got laughter and applause. Cheney had gotten the best of Lieberman, and in an election that was decided by 537 votes, you could reasonably point to that moment and say it changed the outcome. Of course, what Cheney said was not entirely true. It was, in fact, a bald-faced lie. In addition to benefiting from the unprecedented expansion of the entire economy during the Clinton years, Halliburton had received $3.8 billion in government contracts and taxpayer-insured loans while Cheney was its CEO. So the government had absolutely nothing to do with it, had absolutely nothing to do with the truth other than being the opposite of it. Also, I think it's fair to say that Cheney didn't become CEO at Halliburton because of his expertise in oil extraction. It just might have had something to do with his government experience, especially as Secretary of Defense, during the war in the Persian Gulf, which, in case you didn't know, is an area of the world that pumps a lot of oil. And Halliburton did quite a lot of business with countries in that region during Cheney's tenure as CEO. Countries like Iran and Iraq, small problem, federal law prohibited U.S. companies from doing business with the two state sponsors of terrorism. Halliburton circumvented these restrictions by setting up subsidiaries in foreign countries, such as Halliburton Products and Services, which has its headquarters in a Cayman Islands mailbox, and an office in Iran, an axis of evil stalwart. In fact, a company brochure brags about its work on two offshore Iranian drilling contracts, saying that, quote, "We are committed to position ourselves in a market that offers huge growth potential." These deals may very well have been illegal, but for some reason, Bush's Department of Justice hasn't pursued the case. From 1997 through mid-2000, Halliburton's subsidiary, Dresser Industries, sold $30 million worth of water and sewage treatment pumps, spare parts for oil facilities, and pipeline equipment to Saddam Hussein's regime. Cheney lied about this on ABC's This Week on July 30th, 2000, saying, I had a firm policy that we wouldn't do anything in Iraq, even arrangements that were supposedly legal. We've not done any business in Iraq since the sanctions were imposed, and I had a standing policy that I wouldn't do that. Cheney's lie on This Week was no Gore James Lee Witt whopper, but still. Back to Bond Steel 2001 and our show. One of the reasons I love military audiences is that they have a really sick sense of humor. This was their favorite joke. You know, a lot of Americans were really worried about you guys when we started our action here in Kosovo. In fact, I know that kind of constrained what you could do. And fortunately, there were no combat casualties here, but you'll be happy to know that since 9/11, Americans are now willing to take casualties here in Kosovo. They laughed because they knew it was true. Clinton's intervention in Kosovo, which prevented a genocide, did not have our country's wholehearted support. Americans did not like the Serbian atrocities they saw on their televisions, but they were in no mood to see our troops take casualties, certainly not in Kosovo, and certainly not before 9/11. The bombing campaign was particularly unpopular with certain Republicans who had no qualms about expressing their objections while our troops were in harm's way. The president said that if we did nothing, there would be an instability in the region. There would be a flood of refugees, Kosovars would die, and the credibility of NATO would be undermined. Well, Clinton's bombing campaign has caused all these problems to explode. House Majority Whip Tom DeLay, May 2, 1999. This is President Clinton's war, and when he falls flat on his face, that's his problem. Senator Richard Lugar, May 3, 1999. I had doubts about the bombing campaign from the beginning. I didn't think we had done enough in the diplomatic area. Senator Trent Lott, May 4, 1999. They haven't prepared for anything in this, and they're running out of weapons to do it. And frankly, I don't think Clinton has the moral authority or ability to fight this war correctly. Sean Hannity, May 10th, 1999. Thank God Republicans are honorable and understand the patriotic value of constructive dissent. Otherwise, during this year's war in Iraq, guys like Hannity would have gone after any Democrats who were the least bit critical of President Bush. Wait a minute. Here's Hannity on national television. 48 hours we're sending our men and women in harm's way, and there's a leader of your party, Tom Daschle, in the United States Senate, disgracefully attacking our president at a time when we're going off to war. You ought to be ashamed. Every Democrat in this country ought to be ashamed of what this man did yesterday and what he repeated again today. March 18, 2003. What Daschle said was, "I'm saddened that the president failed so miserably at diplomacy that we are now forced to war." I mean, the Democrats, I thought we would always unite behind our troops with the pending conflict, and we have the Democratic leadership in the Senate daily attacking the president even now, March 19th, 2003. You don't have to take cheap, political, partisan shots at the commander-in-chief and say to the world, He doesn't have the experience to lead when he is leading men and women into harm's way. March 27, 2003. Here we are in a conflict, in a war, and the president is trying to direct things, and they just can't put aside their partisanship for 5 minutes and support the troops and support the president. And these are the leaders of the Democratic Party. April 6th, 2003. And a special shout out to Combs for never pointing out Hannity's shameless hypocrisy. The bombing campaign in Kosovo ended on June 10th, 1999, with the signing of a peace accord. Milosevic was kicked out of Belgrade a few months later and sent to The Hague, where he's now on trial for crimes against humanity. I say guilty. And as I pointed out in my joke to the troops, there was not one American combat casualty during the entire campaign. Back again to Kosovo. Flying out in the Chinooks, they made us wear flak jackets and helmets, which always made me feel silly, but on the last trip, as we were headed over the SARS Mountains, the Chinook took a quick turn, then dived. The pilot was taking evasive action. I could see tracers coming at us. We were being shot at. My first thought was about the joke I had told and how funny it would be if I were the first combat fatality in Kosovo. Ah, the mind of a trained comedian. Chapter 19. Who created the tone? Scumbag, sociopath, perpetual preener, rapist, unserious, craven miscreant. Sound like anyone you know? I mean, besides Steven Seagal? Just kidding. I have never heard of Steven Seagal being referred to as a rapist, a sociopath, or unserious. Actually, it was the 42nd president of the United States, Bill Clinton, who was called all of these things. In my day, we never used such language to describe the president unless he was a real asshole like Nixon. Remember during the 2000 campaign how then-Governor Bush kept saying he was going to change the tone in Washington? That really touched a nerve. The partisan rancor in D.C. had led millions of Americans to stop following politics and instead spend hours a day downloading pornography from the Internet. Where did this malicious tone come from in the first place? I submit that it can be traced to a day in 1981 when billionaire Richard Mellon Scaife fielded a reporter's question about his financial backing of conservative groups. "You fucking communist cunt, get out of here," he said to Karen Rothmeier of the Columbia Journalism Review. He went on to tell her that she was ugly and that her teeth were terrible. Of Miss Rothmeier's mother, who was not present, he said, "She's ugly, too." Sensing that it was time to wrap up the interview, Ms. Rothmeier thanked Scaife for his time. He bade her farewell with a cheery, "Don't look behind you." See, that's the funny thing about tone. It's so subjective. Usually, I find it's enough to call someone a fucking communist cunt without having to gild the lily by disparaging her teeth and issuing a veiled death threat. But then again, the Wall Street Journal has never called me the financial archangel for the conservative movement's intellectual underpinnings. In total, Scaife's contribution to right-wing groups, more than 100 of them, adds up to over $200 million. That kind of money can buy a lot of tone. He's given $35 million to the Far-Right Heritage Foundation, backed the Federalist Society, a secretive conservative legal organization which feeds Bush his ultra-conservative judicial nominees and political appointees, and donated to the Cato Institute, the Hoover Institution, Paul Weyrich's Free Congress Foundation, and the American Enterprise Institute. Moreover, he's funded the rise of the right-wing media apparatus, supporting conservative college newspapers and grown-up publications, from the eminently respectable Public Interest to the inarguably disreputable American Spectator. In the 90s, the American Spectator specialized in calling Bill Clinton a murderer. So one could claim that Richard Mellon Scaife set the tone. But as I learned in the 70s, when I personally tried to set the tone of our political culture by repeatedly calling for a return to niceness, it's hard for any one person to shape the character of our national discourse. Now, turning the public arena into a wasteland of personal destruction takes an entire army of like-minded ideologues hell-bent on shredding the already tattered standards of decency that once permitted reasonable discourse on matters of import. The left, sadly, has no such army. Our attack dogs are a scrawny, underfed pack of mutts that spend half the time chasing their own tails and sniffing each other's butts. The right, by contrast, appears to have a well-oiled puppy mill for pit bulls, bred to kill and trained to go for the jugular, or the balls. David Brock was one of those pit bulls. Brock worked as a professional hate spewer for the Washington Times, the Heritage Foundation, and the American Spectator. As aggressive dogs will, Brock left his mark everywhere, on Iran-Contra, the Bork nomination, the Thomas Hill hearings, Troopergate, Paula Jones, Whitewater, and the Clinton impeachment. It was Brock who discredited the very sane, very staid Anita Hill as, quote, a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. Later, Brock had a change of heart and joined the forces of light. In his mea culpa, Blinded by the Right, Brock describes his days in the right-wing trenches. Quote, I fought on the wrong side of an ideological and cultural war that divided our country and poisoned our politics. Brock's revelations about his scandalous activities on behalf of the fanatical right are often discounted by his former compatriots who make the uncharacteristically reasonable argument that he lied so much when he was working for them that nothing he says can be trusted now. Fair enough, we'll leave out Brock's tale of manufacturing Troopergate out of whole cloth, the bottom fishing expeditions of the SCAFE-funded Arkansas Project, and the payoffs to Whitewater witnesses. I'm not going to use it. Don't need it. While Brock does shed light on some of the clandestine dirty tricks used by what was, if not a vast right-wing conspiracy, at least a very, very large one, there were enough lies and baseless innuendos right out in the open to fill a book the size of Sidney Blumenthal's 802-page classic, The Clinton Wars. For example, did you know that Hillary Clinton is a lesbian, and that despite her homosexuality, she was having an affair with Vince Foster, who then had to be murdered to cover up Whitewater? And did you know that Foster's execution was only one small part of a killing spree that claimed nearly 40 lives, including those of former Commerce Secretary Ron Brown and the wife of an Arkansas state trooper who apparently didn't get the message? And did you know that Clinton, to finance his own gargantuan cocaine habit, had struck a deal with the CIA and the Contras to smuggle duffel bags filled with coke into Arkansas? If you didn't, you weren't reading the Wall Street Journal editorial page and the American Spectator and the Washington Times. Typically, the Spectator would break the story, forcing the Journal, the Times, and the New York Post to comment on what was now a legitimate news item that was being ignored by the liberal-dominated media. The Journal ran 64 editorials discussing Foster's death, systematically sowing sinister seeds of suspicion on his so-called suicide. I'm putting the right on notice that they don't own alliteration. This continued even after two successive independent counsels, one of them Kenneth Starr, a man not generally considered to be in Clinton's pocket, concluded that Foster's death was, in fact, a suicide. When readers threatened to tire of seemingly endless Agatha Christie-style discussions of the Foster case, the Journal ran a lurid account of the elimination of two Arkansas teens using that efficient murder weapon favored by Snidely Whiplash, a train. The Journal marshaled these facts. Two teenagers were killed by a train. The train was traveling through Arkansas. Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas. Ergo, Bill Clinton murdered the boys with the train. To offer the Journal a courtesy I'm sure they wouldn't reciprocate, I should explain that their editorial actually suggested that the boys were knifed to death and then put on the train tracks as an elaborate cover-up orchestrated by Clinton and his personal goon squad, the Arkansas State Police. The Journal ran a series of pieces on the boys' deaths and featured the story in their February 12, 1998 editorial, Obstruction and Abuse, a Pattern. The Journal also used its blood-soaked editorial page to publish the 800 number for ordering the Clinton Chronicles, a piece-of-shit video that linked the Clintons to dozens of murders. The Clinton Chronicles sold over 100,000 copies, thanks in large part to the Reverend Jerry Falwell, who co-financed, publicized, and distributed the video through an organization called Citizens for Honest Government, not to be confused with actual citizens who genuinely support honesty in government. The tape cast the deaths of the two teenagers in a larger, more sinister context. Narrator: a number of people approached the police about Don and Kevin's murders and were subsequently murdered themselves. Meanwhile, over at the Washington Times, a dedicated band of courageous journalists dared to expose the slaughter in Arkansas, heedless of the inevitable lethal consequences for themselves and their families. Their editor-in-chief, Wesley Pruden, led the charge. Pruden's September 18, 1998 editorial reads like a Bill O'Reilly suspense novel. Jane Parks was the wife then of Jerry Parks, who was the security chief of the Clinton-Gore campaign in Arkansas in 1992. His son Gary told Ambrose Evans Pritchard of the Sunday Telegraph that he was watching a TV newscast with his father when Vince Foster's death was announced. The father went pale. "I'm a dead man," he told the son. "They're cleaning house." He told his wife Jane that he would be next. A few months later, he was cut down in a volley of automatic weapons fire on a Little Rock street corner. And what would an O'Reilly-esque thriller be without some blow and a few underage babes? Jane Parks, the manager of a Little Rock apartment house, told the London Sunday Telegraph that Roger Clinton, the president's bad boy brother, turned apartment B-107 into a drug pad in the summer of 84, where it snowed every night and young girls, some of them still in high school, were the bunnies who served themselves with the salad. The governor was a frequent visitor, so her story goes, and the rutting and snorting noises that drifted up through the vents occasionally got so loud she had to leave. After Vince Foster, probably the most notorious of the Clinton murders, was his airborne rub-out of Commerce Secretary and longtime friend Ron Brown. Appearing on Hannity and Combs, Christopher Ruddy, author of the delightful The Strange Death of Vince Foster, and a reporter for the Scaife fish wrapper, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, advanced a theory that Brown had been shot in the back of the head before his plane crashed in Croatia, killing all 35 aboard. Hannity: Chris, welcome back. By the way, Chris, that Mike McCurry in a recent interview singled you out as one of the people that the haters of Clinton, if you will. You have this report about Ron Brown that you've been going forward with, medical examiners, including Lieutenant Colonel Cogswell, that he may have been shot. You're just reporting these things. Why would the spokesperson for the president single you out as, quote, one of those haters? Ruddy: Well, I think it's a great honor to be declared an enemy. Hannity failed to point out that Colonel William T. Gormley, the Air Force pathologist who, unlike Cogswell, had actually examined Brown's body, said that, quote, there is no doubt in anybody's mind who evaluated his case that this was a blunt force injury and not a gunshot wound. X-rays of the corpse showed no bone or metal fragments, no exit wound, and no bullet. And besides, the logic of shooting someone before crashing their plane escapes me. Though I will concede it does bear a highly suspicious resemblance to the earlier case of the teens who were stabbed before being run over by a train. Which is perhaps why Fox's Brit Hume said of the Ron Brown shooting, crashing, dying conspiracy, it's a story that's worth giving airtime to. And given airtime on Fox and Inc. in the Washington Times, the story inevitably made its way into the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post, Time, and ABC News, if only in reporting, as Newsweek put it, the life and times of a rumor. Though outraged at Clinton's unquenchable thirst for murder, it was his career as a serial rapist which provided the bitterest grill for the right-wing rumor mill. Who cares if our president is a molester, a rapist, even a serial rapist? Joseph Sobran inquired rhetorically of Washington Times readers. The influential website Newsmax.com, available to most Americans thanks to Al Gore's visionary funding of the Internet, explained in their probing story behind the story, Bill's Biting Ways, why Clinton nearly bit Juanita Broderick's lower lip in two while raping her. Bill O'Reilly deplored not only Clinton's alleged rape of Broderick, but also the mainstream media's rape of the American public in failing to report the alleged rape. In a 2001 interview with Media Week, O'Reilly declared that the Los Angeles Times was an abysmal paper, in part because, quote, they never mentioned Juanita Broderick's name ever. This whole Los Angeles area out here has no idea what's going on unless you watch my show. LA Times editor Melissa Payton corrected O'Reilly by pointing out that her paper's archives contain 21 articles mentioning Broderick and that, contrary to O'Reilly's further claim, virtually her entire newspaper is devoted to information about what's going on, including not only news but movie times and also free community events for the whole family, such as weekend puppet shows and please touch nature walks at local parks. I'm sorry, I got off the question of who set the tone and back into the question of why does Bill O'Reilly lie so goddamn much? So let's follow the tone. It begins with Richard fucking Mellon communist cunt Scaife moves through the shadowy world of sleazy right-wing operatives into the radical right fringe press, American Spectator, over to the thinly disguised radical right-wing media, Washington Times and Fox News Channel, and on to the quasi-respectable right-wing press, Wall Street Journal, editorial page. Gathering strength, the tone finally vaults into the mainstream media, LA Times, Newsweek, ABC, CNN, etc., where it is disseminated into the homes of millions of unsuspecting Americans. But even as the right was spreading filth, sleaze, and bile through its media apparatus, a parallel effort was proceeding in the political arena. Ever hear of someone named Newt Gingrich? I know it sounds like I made the name up, but he was once one of the most powerful men in America. He was so powerful that he said, quote, people like me are what stand between us and Auschwitz. Some people believe Gingrich fell from power because of his grandiosity. One way Gingrich stood between us and Auschwitz was by being extremely mean and nasty. Sharing his secrets for success with Republican candidates, he sent out a letter advising them to characterize their Democratic opponents with words like corrupt, sick, pathetic, greedy, and traitor. Gingrich's recipe for success, go negative early and never back off, proved so successful that in 1994 the Republicans captured the House and Senate by soundly defeating such pathetic traitors as Tennessee Senator Jim Sasser. Now in the majority, the Republicans were free to elevate the tone by shutting down the government and engaging in dozens of separate investigations of the Clinton administration. Joe Lockhart, former Clinton press secretary, describes the GOP's SOB's SOP. What they do is they would use the power of the subpoena to get document after document out of the White House that they would then distort and leak, and it was warfare. I mean, it was from the very first day Bill Clinton went in there, there was a declared war on him. Why did they hate Clinton so much? I think it was because we, and by that I mean Bill, Hillary, and myself, I think we represented everything they despised. We were young. We were charismatic. The mauling of Clinton was payback for Nixon, Bork, Iran-Contra, and Clarence Thomas. Every time we caught them doing something wrong, they got even madder. But more than that, it was payback for the 60s. Freedom riding, bra burning, pot smoking, free loving, tree hugging, draft dodging, Woodstock attending, Woodstock overdosing, God not fearing, and carrot cake. They've never forgiven us for carrot cake. I don't defend everything that happened in the 60s, just as I don't defend everything that happened in any decade. The current decade, for instance, is not off to the best of starts. But to the right, the Clintons embodied all of a generation's vices and none of its virtues. The Clintons' energy, their intellectual intensity, their compassion for those on the margins of society, their fundamental belief that the world could be made a better place. The right found all of these extremely irritating. So they weren't content just to call him a murderer and a rapist. The fact that Clinton continued to be successful and popular left only one option. Clinton had to be removed. Determined not to sink to his level and have the president conveniently run over by a train, the Republicans took the high road and impeached him on blowjob charges. The story of Clinton's impeachment has been told many times and in many ways, though not yet in opera, which I believe is the form to which it is best suited. One version of the story came from Kenneth Starr, who made his own perverse contribution to the tone in Washington with his gratuitously pornographic Starr Report, which my publisher says I cannot quote if I want this book sold in Walmart. The tone that Bush had promised to change had been created by his own party. His pledge to change that tone contained both a promise and a threat. Elect me, and the tone will improve because I am a consensus builder, a uniter, not a divider, and a compassionate conservative. Elect Gore, and we'll nuke the living fuck out of him just like we did the last guy. America, the choice is yours. Chapter 20. Did the tone change? No. Chapter 21. Why would anyone think it would change? Everything you need to know about the legitimacy of Bush's claim to the moral high ground can be summed up by the conduct of his campaign in the South Carolina Republican primary. You may remember that Senator John McCain, like Bush, a Vietnam-era fighter pilot, with one key difference, McCain actually fought in his fighter, had roundly defeated the Texas governor in New Hampshire. McCain's Straight Talk Express was gathering momentum. Something had to be done. In February of 2000, lucky Republican voters in South Carolina began receiving phone calls assessing their feelings about a series of important issues. A typical call began like this. Caller: Hi, I'm calling from an independent polling company, and I was wondering if I could have a minute of your time to conduct a survey. Unsuspecting voter: Sure. Great. If you knew that Senator John McCain was a cheat and a liar and a fraud, and that he has fathered an illegitimate black child, would you be more likely to vote for him or less likely to vote for him?
Probably less.
As you might have gathered, the calls were not actually made by independent polling companies, nor were they intended to gather information. They were a particularly insidious example of push polling, a technique invented by Bush Jr.'s political guru, Lee Atwater. Push polls are a sneaky way to spread lies about your opponent while appearing to keep your own hands clean. To my knowledge, McCain has not fathered any illegitimate children of any race. He and his wife Cindy did, however, adopt a Bangladeshi girl, Bridget, who has dark skin and appeared regularly with her parents at campaign events, thus granting the rumor an especially sinister veneer of plausibility. Nice work, Bush campaign. By the way, I myself suggested a retaliatory push poll to a friend in the McCain camp. It went like this. Hi, we're an independent polling company. If you knew that during the 5.5 years that John McCain was being tortured in Hanoi, that George W. Bush snorted 5.5 kilograms of cocaine, would you be more likely to vote for Governor Bush or less likely to vote for Governor Bush?
Less likely?
The heartwarming story of the very first push poll. Lee Atwater, a mentor to both Karl Rove and George Jr., ran the very first push poll in 1978 against a friend of mine, Max Heller. I met Max and his wife Millie in Hilton Head in 1994. His intelligence, good humor, and obvious decency reminded me of my father, who had recently died. Max told me his story. In the late 1930s, Millie and her family left South Carolina for a vacation in Austria, where she met Max and fell in love. Millie and her family went back to South Carolina, and the two lovebirds kept in touch. When Hitler invaded Austria, Max decided it might be time for him to become an American. Arriving in Charleston, Max was greeted by Millie and her dad, who offered him room and board. Max refused to accept a handout and insisted on doing a day's work sweeping at Millie's dad's warehouse before he would sleep in their guest room and eat at their table. Max and Millie were married and prospered. Eventually, he became the beloved mayor of Greenville, and in 1978 ran for Congress against an Atwater client, Republican Carol Campbell. Heller was ahead until Atwater commissioned a series of polls to discover how voters in the district would feel about, quote, a foreign-born Jew who did not believe in Jesus Christ as the Savior. The polls revealed a certain antipathy to such a person. Max lost. Other rumors about McCain that began circulating around this time were that he was gay, he's not, that he was pro-abortion, he isn't, that his wife had outstanding arrest warrants for giving alcohol to minors, she didn't, that he had voted for the largest tax increase ever, he hadn't, that he had been reprimanded by the Senate Ethics Committee, he hadn't, and that he had fathered an illegitimate child with a North Vietnamese woman, which was why he'd gotten special treatment from the Viet Cong. This one's true. McCain's illegitimate child, John McCain Vu Khan, is currently Minister of Bicycles of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam. Despite the fact that the sliming of McCain could have benefited no one but Bush, and possibly the distant also-ran Alan Keyes, who himself was facing allegations of having fathered three black children, the Bush campaign repeatedly protested its innocence. However, in a candid moment captured by C-SPAN on February 12th, W. tipped his hand to South Carolina State Senator Mike Fair. They didn't know the camera was on them as they spoke about McCain. Senator Fair, you haven't hit his soft spots. Bush, I know I'm going to. Fair, well, they need to. Somebody does anyway. Bush, I agree. I'm not going to do it on TV. The mastermind behind Bush's Dirty Tricks campaign in South Carolina and beyond was a man by the name of Karl Rove, whose fleshy and formless physique belies a heart as cold and steely and deadly as a discarded refrigerator with a door still attached in an elementary school playground during a Minnesota winter. Rove, whose official White House title is Senior Political Advisor, has so much influence over the president that he's been described as Bush's brain in the book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. Any student of Rove's personal history would not be surprised by the chicanery in South Carolina. In 1970, while still a teenager, Rove pretended to be a campaign volunteer for the Democratic candidate for Illinois State Treasurer Alan J. Dixon. He swiped Dixon's letterhead and sabotaged the opening of Dixon's campaign headquarters by sending out over 1,000 copies of an invitation offering, quote, free beer, free food, girls, and a good time for nothing to homeless shelters and soup kitchens. He now refers to this as a youthful prank that he regrets. A few years later, a rapidly maturing Rove conducted training sessions for college Republicans on the nuance and technique of Nixon-style dirty tricks. George Bush Sr., who was then head of the Republican National Committee, had to send the FBI to question the up-and-coming scam artist. Bush was so impressed that he later gave Rove a job. In 1986, while working on the Texas gubernatorial race, a fully blossomed Rove dramatically discovered a mysterious electronic bug in his office. Instead of calling the police, he called a press conference. The timing of Rove's discovery was particularly fortunate. It was the morning of the only televised debate between his candidate, William Clements, and the Democratic governor, Mark White. White was forced to answer questions about the bug instead of about the issues and subsequently lost. The Travis County DA's office and the FBI later concluded that the bug had been planted by Rove himself on the same day he discovered it. The fact that the maximum battery life of the bug was a mere 10 hours, meaning that a spy would have to sneak in and replace it at least twice a day, may have been something of a giveaway. Rove's innovative approach to campaign strategy propelled him rapidly up the ladder to the top of the state Republican Party, where he orchestrated the most complete takeover of Texas since Sam Houston routed Santa Anna at the Battle of San Jacinto. Sam Houston was later killed at the Alamo by terrorists. By 2000, Rove knew how to steal an election without leaving any fingerprints. According to McCain's then-campaign manager, Rick Davis, Rove had a seasoned team of character assassins already in place, including Warren Tompkins, another Atwater disciple, and former Christian Coalition executive director Ralph Reed. Davis told me that Reed later claimed, quote, "I was the one who delivered South Carolina for W." Phone banks, flyers, emails, church pulpits, and in one undocumented case, telepathy, all these were used as weapons of McCain destruction, as Bill Schneider might have called them, on CNN's Inside Politics. One such email came from Bob Jones University professor Richard Hand, who wrote to fellow South Carolinians that McCain, quote, "chose to sire children without marriage." When Hand was told on CNN that there was no evidence Senator McCain had fathered illegitimate children, Hand, displaying the intelligent rigor for which Bob Jones University is justifiably esteemed worldwide, said, "That's a universal negative. Can you prove that?" You may remember that it was at Bob Jones University that George W. Bush kicked off his South Carolina campaign. The ultra-fundamentalist school was famously anti-Roman Catholic and had a quirky policy against interracial dating. "We had to send a message fast, and sending him there was the only way to do it," Warren Tompkins would later say. Bush was criticized nationally for not addressing the school's ban on interracial dating. You know who I think would have criticized their interracial dating policy? Thomas Jefferson. Bush won South Carolina and went on to capture the Republican nomination and came within a hair's breadth of winning the election. The following scene is excerpted from The Big Heist, my novelization of the Republican conspiracy to steal the election in Florida. The book was inspired by Bill O'Reilly's Those Who Trespass and Jeffrey Toobin's Too Close to Call, the 36-day battle to decide the 2000 election. Note, while the Republicans did send lobbyist Max Stepanovich to babysit Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris during the entire 36-day fiasco, the depiction of a sexual affair between the two of them is purely fictional, as far as I know. Florida, November. A 43-year-old woman named Katherine Harris paced back and forth on a colorless carpet in an office that smelled of sweaty seersucker and day-old perfume. Nearby, a trim, goateed man was fanning himself lazily with a Panama hat while lying on the couch.
"I swear, Katherine, I'm sweating like a nigger on election day. Can't we crank up the AC in here?"
"Just tell me what to do, Mac. Just tell me what to do."
"I told you what to do, baby. I told you to turn up the AC. The important thing is that you don't lose your cool."
"Mac, you don't understand,"
Harris said, worrying a blood-red fingernail.
"When I was elected Secretary of State, I never suspected I'd actually have to do anything."
Stepanovich chuckled, then lifted a haunch and let out a long, rattling fart.
"You have to bring this election in for a landing, Kathy."
"I'm not cut out for this, Mac. I've never stolen an election before,"
Harris said, her voice quavering on the edge of hysteria. Stepanovich stood up sharply, took three long strides across the office, and slapped the trembling woman across the face. Hard.
"I'm only going to say this once, Kathy. I'm not leaving this office until the Texans in the White House. I'm here to take care of you, Kathy. In any way I can."
A wave of calm, mingled with desire, washed over Florida's highest-ranking election official. It was good to have a man around, a real man, not one of those country club milksops, but a living, breathing, farting man. Everyone who mattered in Florida knew Max Stepanovich. For corporate interests in the Sunshine State, Stepanovich was the man to see for the project that absolutely had to be approved, the bill that simply had to pass. Stepanovich knew where the bodies were buried. Hell, he had buried more than a few of them himself.
"Hold me, Mac. I'm scared."
"I'll do more than hold you, baby,"
he said, crushing his mouth to her lips. Harris recoiled at the acrid taste of cigars and rye.
"You stink, Mac."
"I know, baby, and I know you love it."
"I can't do this, Mac. I don't have the power to deny the Gore request for recounts. It's not up to me. It's up to each county's 3-member canvassing board, each of which is comprised of the local election supervisor, a county judge, and an elected county commissioner.
Stepanovich pulled her close with his left hand and raised his right hand menacingly.
Listen to me good, sweet cheeks. Here's how we're going to play it. You prohibit the manual recounts by issuing opinion letters. As a chief elections officer for the state, you offer binding interpretations of Florida election law.
Harris sighed.
Oh, you're going to have to be strong, Mac. For both of us.
I will. I am.
Stepanovich smiled. He was thinking of that phone call that had pulled him away from a nice warm bar stool and an even warmer redhead. His old friends in the Bush campaign needed someone to babysit the Secretary of State. That the Secretary of State was one beautiful baby was icing on the cake. Stepanovich turned, walked to the desk, and refilled his tumbler from the half-empty bottle of cheap hooch. He turned back and whistled softly. Those calls to the county canvassing board would have to wait. Max Stepanovich had work to do. Harris was now wearing only brief white panties. She had signaled her desire by removing her shirt and skirt, and by leaning back on the couch. She closed her eyes, concentrating on nothing but Stepanovich's tongue and lips. He gently teased her by licking the areas around her most sensitive erogenous zone. Then he slipped her panties down her legs, and within seconds, his tongue was inside her, moving rapidly. That's how it happened. The true story of the stealing of the presidency. Oh, there was more to it than just a sweaty sexual encounter in a small office with a broken air conditioner. There was the Harris-directed purging of thousands of legitimate black voters from the rolls, the relentless legal and extra-legal efforts to prevent an accurate counting of the votes, including a manufactured mob of Republican congressional aides flown in from Washington to scream and pound on the doors of the Miami-Dade canvassing board, the double standard the Bush campaign applied to military ballots, stretching the law to accept those in Bush counties, even as they were challenging those in counties that went for Gore, all while accusing the Democrats of, quote, going to war against the men and women who serve in our armed forces in an effort to win at any cost. Although Republicans controlled every lever of power in the state, they shrieked that the venal Democrats were subverting the system to steal the presidency. But if there's one enduring symbol of the Florida coup d'etat, it is the tongue of Max Stepanovich, the Republican lobbyist who was put in Harris's office to be her minder. That tongue not only brought almost unimaginable pleasure to Catherine Harris, but also to Jeb Bush, Karl Rove, and George W. Bush. I'm not suggesting he had sex with the Bushes or even Karl Rove, but I can't say for sure that he didn't. As BJU Professor Richard Hand would point out, that's a universal negative and impossible to prove. Once Clarence Thomas, after considering the matter dispassionately, had cast the deciding vote in Bush versus Gore, thereby allowing his wife to continue her work for the Bush transition team, the new president-elect addressed the nation. After a difficult election, we must put politics behind us and work together to make the promise of America available for every one of our citizens. I am optimistic that we can change the tone in Washington, D.C. I believe things happen for a reason, and I hope the long wait of the last 5 weeks will heighten a desire to move beyond the bitterness and partisanship of the recent past. Our nation must rise above a house divided. Americans share hopes and goals and values far more important than any political disagreements. Republicans want the best for our nation, and so do Democrats. Our votes may differ, but not our hopes. I know America wants reconciliation and unity. I know Americans want progress, and we must seize this moment and deliver. Together, guided by a spirit of common sense, common courtesy, and common goals, we can unite and inspire the American citizens. I couldn't sleep that night, not from bitterness for having had the election stolen by human filth like Karl Rove, but because I, too, share the President-elect's vision of a united America reconciled by our shared dream of a better tomorrow. my optimism that we could put the past behind us and, yes, change the tone, lasted the better part of 3 weeks. Chapter 22, I Grow Discouraged About the Tone. The first hint that America was not headed for a golden age of reconciliation and unity of purpose might have been Bush's nomination of John Ashcroft to be the nation's chief law enforcement officer. A ferocious opponent of a woman's right to choose to have an abortion, a man's right to choose to have sex with another man, and a third man's right to choose to film them, Ashcroft was Bush's sop to the religious right. By the time the Bush team occupied the White House, it was clear the tone had indeed changed, for the worse. With all the gravity of the Talmudic scholar cum Hollywood agent he so closely resembled, Press Secretary Ari Fleischer addressed a story recently leaked to the Washington Post. Criminal elements within the departing White House staff had committed a despicable outrage at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Referring more in sadness than in anger to the vandalism, Fleischer demurred, "I chose not to describe what acts were done that we found upon arrival because I think that's part of changing the tone in Washington, thereby leaving it up to the press corps to imagine shits taken on desks, vomit in filing cabinets, and TP covering the Rose Garden." To paraphrase Groucho Marx, truth goes out the door when rumor comes innuendo. Whether things were done that were perhaps less gracious than should have been, it is not going to be what President Bush focuses on, nor will it be what his staff focuses on, said the high-minded Fleischer, who continued to flog the story for weeks. Meanwhile, media outlets were receiving leaks from anonymous Republican sources, sickened by the most extensive sack of the White House since the War of 1812. Trash was everywhere, one told CNN. Phone and computer lines had been cut, expletive-ridden graffiti written on the walls, file cabinets glued shut, and pictures stolen. The Washington Times quoted a Matt Drudge story titled, "White House Offices Left Trashed, Porn Bombs, Lewd Messages." Unlike Matt Drudge, I've never experienced a porn bombing. I can only imagine that a porn bomb is a form of a dirty bomb consisting of a conventional explosive surrounded by a thick coating of dirty books and pictures. When the bomb goes off, the filth, either images or bits of text, could contaminate schoolyards, churches, and even John Ashcroft's morning prayer meeting. In the first week after the story broke, Fox brought up the vandalism story 13 times. Uber-conservative Grover Norquist told CNN that there have been reports coming out of the White House of damage up to $200,000. There have been obscenities scrawled. People have called in and gotten answering machines with obscenities attached to them. There have been pornographic things in the computers, viruses in the computer. I got a call from somebody at the White House today who said, "You can't call me back. Phone lines have been cut and damaged. I'll try to reach you next week, just in the context of doing business. And I'll give you my phone number, but it won't work. I called in and it didn't." There's evidently been extensive damage, but I think while Bush, and he's instructed his people to be very, very low-key on this because it really reflects very poorly on the presidency and the White House and the previous occupants, that it is important to document what happened because if you don't take pictures of it, you don't document it, we know the Clintons will deny it ever happened. In fact, Fleischer assured the press that while there was no investigation, quote, "What we are doing is cataloging that which took place." Of course, none of this horrible vandalism actually occurred, but Georgia firebrand Congressman Bob Barr had not been clued in on the ruse. Outraged, he demanded an immediate investigation by Congress's General Accounting Office. 14 months later, this, the final investigation of the Clinton administration, yielded a 217-page report that found no damage to the White House nor to the executive office building. Quote, "There is no record of damage that may have been deliberately caused by employees of the Clinton administration." The White House had been damaged, but not by Bill Clinton. No, the vandals were Karl Rove, Ari Fleischer, and their lickspittles in the right-wing press. And while no shits were found, Grover Norquist could not have done more damage had he taken a dump in each of the White House's 132 rooms. The Bush administration had established its game plan. Pretend to stay above the fray, use surrogates to lie, attack, and discredit, then get the media to report it. And parallel to the campaign to get the message out, there was a no less vigorous effort to keep certain messages in. Dana Milbank of the Washington Post incurred official disfavor by writing about the taboo subject of how much the president loves to lie. A prescient article in the fall of 2002 questioned several of Bush's overblown claims regarding an imminent Iraqi threat to America. In light of subsequent events, e.g. the fact that Saddam did not pose much of a military threat to Americans in Baghdad, let alone Cincinnati, one can see why Milbank aroused the ire of the White House press operation. By withholding routine information such as travel itineraries from troublesome reporters like Milbank, the White House was able to prevent them from asking embarrassing questions. It's hard to ask the president embarrassing questions if you can't find him. It wasn't just the White House. Over at the Pentagon, tough guy Donald Rumsfeld knew how to court-martial a nosy reporter. "This is by far the worst it's ever been," said Thomas Ricks of the Washington Post, a 10-year veteran of the Pentagon beat. When Ricks asked why he had been excluded from a trip on which American journalists were allowed to cover a special forces operation for the first time, a press affairs officer told him, "We don't like your stories, and we don't like the questions you've been asking." Since that incident, the only question Ricks has asked is, "What kind of story would you like to see in the Washington Post tomorrow?" A top news executive at one of the three major networks who spoke with me through an intermediary on the condition of anonymity for both of them, and who insisted that I give no distinguishing information about him or her, said off the record, quote, "This is the most cowed White House press corps in history." Those early months were heady days for George W. Bush. Emboldened by his landslide victory, Bush passed a $1.6 trillion tax cut, which went primarily to the rich, pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol, delayed rules that would reduce acceptable levels of arsenic in the drinking water, and implemented the enormously successful Operation Ignore. Ironically, it took a man of Bush's own party to bring his extended honeymoon to a close. Jim Jeffords, an obscure senator from a little-known state called Vermont, had been on the receiving end of a series of petty slights provoked by his bothersome habit of voting his conscience. To punish Jeffords, the cagey Karl Rove had decided not to invite him to a White House ceremony honoring one of Jeffords' own constituents, Michelle Foreman of Middlebury, as the Teacher of the Year. Boy, did that backfire. As I can tell you from experiences with my wife's family, and particularly her Uncle Ray, New Englanders are a singularly cranky and short-tempered group of people. Not being invited to a Teacher of the Year ceremony is just the type of thing that would piss them off. Jeffords quit the Republican Party, throwing control of the Senate to the Democrats. Emboldened by Jeffords' example, the Washington press corps suddenly found its pecker again. Stories critical of Bush's handling of the Teacher of the Year ceremony, of the secret Cheney Energy Task Force, and of the president's interminable vacations began to appear not just in the German media, but in some American papers as well. Suddenly on the defensive, Karl Rove counterattacked with a series of photo ops of the president reading "The Very Hungry Caterpillar" to kindergartners, which is exactly what he was doing when Operation Ignore came to an abrupt and disastrous conclusion. After being chased around the country by imaginary terrorists for 9 hours, Bush returned to Washington and addressed a jittery nation. Far from comforting the American people, the president, who appeared to be genuinely terrified himself, further unsettled the country by stammering through a pallid and perfunctory statement. 9 days later, having overcome his panic, the president capped an astonishing recovery by delivering an inspiring speech to a joint session of Congress. It was only in retrospect that I realized that the skillfully crafted address contained seeds of a Manichean view that divides the world into good and evil, us and them, black and white, American and other. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, The American people put aside their differences over, for instance, whether cutting $1 billion from the Environmental Protection Agency was a good idea or not, and got behind our president, as well we should have. After winning a swift victory in Afghanistan with Bill Clinton's military, Bush's approval rating shot up to an unprecedented 112%. The media's testicles instantly shriveled and retracted back into their abdominal cavities, making a slurping sound as they did so. Afraid to appear unpatriotic or treasonous, even left-leaning periodicals like The Daily Worker, The Young Spartacist, and The New York Times wrote glowing articles about the president. Instead of using this unique moment of national unity to usher in a new American century founded upon a reasonable measure of shared sacrifice, Bush and Rove decided to ask nothing of average Americans other than that they silently acquiesce to their eventual enslavement by a corporate hegemon. Wealthy Americans, however, would be asked only to accept larger and larger tax cuts and ever weaker oversight from the underfunded Securities and Exchange Commission. Ordinary citizens were asked to do their part in the war on terrorism by remaining alert and reporting suspicious packages and neighbors. A new color-coded alert system was instituted for purposes of alarming Americans with a fine-tuned precision. At the orange level, the second highest level of alert, people are still encouraged to go to the mall. At the red level, the highest state of alert, the president suggests that you stay away from public places and instead shop online. These days at airports, Americans stand cheerfully in line at the Cinnabon counter. Nearby, another longer line of slightly less cheerful air travelers waits patiently to surrender their nail scissors, even though it seems extremely unlikely that the terrorists will strike in that precise way again. Personally, I think they're more likely to get us with a porn bomb. First of all, there's no way the hijackers could ever get past the reinforced cockpit door. Secondly, every guy in first class has now deputized himself, desperate to support the floundering airline industry and make a few bucks on the corporate lecture circuit. I flew often in the months following September 11th. Invariably, when I sat down, the guy next to me would say something like, "I played high school football. How about you?" "I wrestled," I would reply. "Any trouble, we'll kill him, right?" Yeah, we'll kill him." Actually, and this is totally true, for the first 6 months after 9/11, I put 3 baseballs in my carry-on bag. See, I am blessed with an unusually accurate throwing arm and wanted more than anything to thwart a hijacking by beaning a terrorist. How American is that? I imagine the New York Post headline, "Franken beans hijacker. Terrorist hit in face with more balls than Elton John." In its October 19, 2002 issue, the conservative British news magazine, The Economist, wrote that, quote, "Mr. Bush is as partisan a president as America has ever had." That includes George Washington, whom the British had little reason to love. A window into just how exclusively political the thinking is at the Bush White House was opened by University of Pennsylvania professor John DeIlio, whom the president had appointed to head the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. DeIlio quit the office in February of 2002 after only one of its initiatives, the Faith-Based Bureau of Weights and Measures, came to fruition. The FBBWM had some success in reintroducing the cubit by requiring the biblical unit of measurement be used in plans for new federal buildings. DeIlio stupidly wrote a 7-page letter to Esquire's Ron Suskind to provide background for Suskind's article on Karl Rove's role as senior advisor in the Bush White House. Quote, "There is no precedent in any modern White House for what is going on in this one, a complete lack of a policy apparatus," DeIlio admitted in the soon-to-be-much-regretted letter. What you got is everything, and I mean everything, run by the political arm. It's the reign of the Mayberry Machiavellis, he said. DeIlio contrasted the Bush White House with Clinton's, where, quote, "every domestic issue drew multiple policy analyses that certainly weighted politics, media messages, legislative strategy, etc., but also strongly weighted policy-relevant information, stimulated substantive policy debate, and put a premium on policy knowledge. That is simply not Bush's style," unquote. Several paragraphs later, DeIlio gave what might very well be the key to the Bush administration's startling lack of accomplishment in the domestic sphere, other than budget-busting, deficit-bloating tax cuts. Quote, on social policy and related issues, the lack of even basic policy knowledge and the only casual interest in knowing more was somewhat breathtaking. According to DeIlio, Bush's staff, quote, consistently talked and acted as if the height of political sophistication consisted in reducing every issue to its simplest black-and-white terms for public consumption, then steering legislative initiatives or policy proposals as far-right as possible. Of Rove, DeIlio said, quote, Carl is enormously powerful, maybe the single most powerful person in the modern post-Hoover era ever to occupy a political advisor post near the Oval Office. Evidently, DeIlio never met a poised young woman in the Clinton White House by the name of Dee Dee Myers. We will fuck him, do you hear me? We will fuck him. We will ruin him like no one has ever fucked him. Now, I like a little dirty talk as much as the next fellow. The only difference between me and Karl Rove is that I like to keep it in the bedroom. Rove's fucking quote was reported by Susskind, who overheard the meltdown while waiting outside Rove's office. The name of the man about to be fucked may never be known, but it's safe to say that he was fucked like no one had ever fucked him. One person not afforded the courtesy of being fucked in private was Tom Daschle, who, because of Jeffords' defection, was now Senate Majority Leader. One GOP official told the New Republic that orders to crush Daschle had come directly from the West Wing. Rush Limbaugh, a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican Party, began referring to Daschle as El Diablo. Limbaugh's Spanish-speaking listeners got the message. Daschle was either a devil or the devil. No one on Team Franken ever took Spanish. In the fall of 2001, ads began to appear comparing the somewhat liberal El Diablo to more radical political figures, such as Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and American Taliban John Walker Lind. What do Saddam Hussein and Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle have in common? Asked a newspaper ad that juxtaposed the two men. Neither man wants America to drill for oil in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Also, both men are Libras. After 9/11, the balance between civil liberties and national security would be put to a severe test. Fortunately for those who came down heavily on the national security side, John Ashcroft was the one making most of the close calls. Could we round up immigrants and not let them see lawyers? Sure. Could we conduct all their hearings in secret? Yes. Could we detain Muslims who had done nothing wrong by calling them material witnesses? Fabulous idea. Could we keep people locked up for months in horrifying conditions without letting their families know they'd been detained? Why not? Those who came down on the civil liberties side had to watch what they said. As Ashcroft told the Senate Judiciary Committee on December 6, 2001, to those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty, my message is this. Your tactics only aid terrorists, for they erode our national unity and diminish our resolve. They give ammunition to America's enemies. This wasn't a nutcase like Ann Coulter shouting treason. This was the Attorney General of the United States, who is also something of a nutcase. In his book, Lessons from a Father to His Son, Ashcroft explained that he anointed himself with oil before being sworn in for each of his two terms as Missouri's governor, in the tradition of, quote, the ancient kings of Israel, David and Saul, who were anointed as they undertook their administrative duties. Ashcroft also anointed himself before being sworn in as senator with, swear to God, a bowl of Crisco, a trick that used to be popular in gay bathhouses. Then there was the thing with the statue. The Attorney General gives his press conferences from the Great Hall of the Department of Justice headquarters. Behind the podium, visible over the AG's right shoulder, stands a statue of a woman that represents the spirit of justice.
The 18-foot aluminum statue has her arms raised and a toga draped over her body, leaving her left breast exposed. So, according to ABC News, Ashcroft ordered the Spirit of Justice's tit draped at a cost of $8,000. He didn't like being photographed in front of another boob. What does that mean? What is it like for John Ashcroft when he takes a trip to Rome? Does he walk around with an erection all the time? And $8,000, you know, I have a better idea for what to do with that money. Use it to fight terrorism. Buy the FBI a new computer. Remember how during the Senate House Intelligence Committee hearings on the FBI, agents testified that the Bureau's computers could not do the equivalent of a Google search? Because of a security measure known as stovepiping, they cannot search for two words at a time. They can't search for Al-Qaeda. To search for Al-Qaeda, they first have to go through every Al. They go through me, they go through Al Gore, they have to read every Weird Al Yankovic lyric. By contrast, someone with Google can go straight to the Al-Qaeda homepage with its valuable searchable member database. The White House had fought hearings on the intelligence agencies until it was shamed into them after Americans learned of the president's August 6, 2001 briefing regarding Al-Qaeda's unwholesome intentions. That information had been leaked as part of an escalating feud between the FBI and the CIA over which was more to blame for 9/11. In keeping with the spirit of Operation Ignore, the Bush administration had done nothing to encourage cooperation between the two agencies. As Jim Walsh, an expert on terrorism at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, told me, "We expected another attack, but we didn't do the first thing you'd do to prevent it." One highlight of the hearings was the testimony of Agent Colleen Rowley, a courageous whistleblower from the Minneapolis Bureau, who reminded the country how the Bush administration had committed the cardinal sin of dropping the ball while failing to connect the dots. In a desperate bid to change the subject, President Bush proposed the most sweeping reorganization of the federal government since the Truman administration. Suddenly, after arguing against it for 9 months, Bush and Rove made an about-face and decided to create a cabinet-level Department of Homeland Security. John DeIlio described it as, quote, "remarkably slapdash and a politically timed reversal, which had received little more than talking points deliberation." Immediately, Democrats like Joe Lieberman and Georgia Senator Max Cleland, who had months earlier written legislation urging such a reorganization, fell into line behind the plan. Bush had turned the lemons of embarrassment into the lemonade of a popular idea. Little did the Democrats suspect that this seemingly bipartisan lemonade would be served with a date rape pill. The pill came in the form of a provision to deprive the new department's employees of civil service protection. It was a brilliant move. Democrats were put in the awkward position of voting against the Homeland Security Department or betraying one of their most loyal constituencies, one that needed to be insulated from coercive political pressures. As Cleland would put it, "I don't think you make America more safe by making the workers that protect America more unsafe." When Senate Democrats voted against the legislation, President Bush didn't hesitate to debase the debate. "The Senate is more interested in special interests in Washington and not interested in the security of the American people," Bush railed at a fundraiser in New Jersey. The tone was set for the 2002 midterm elections. When you think of someone who isn't interested in the security of the American people, you think of Senator Max Cleland, wheeling his merry way through the marble halls of the Capitol. You see, Max left three of his limbs in Vietnam. A VC grenade blew them off. Cleland is a war hero. Conservative Georgians first elected him to the Senate in 1996 on the basis of his unquestionable integrity and selfless loyalty to his country. And yet, he lost his bid for re-election in 2002, largely because of attacks on his patriotism. Cleland's opponent, Saxby Chambliss, was not a war hero. He got out of Vietnam because of a bad knee. Cleland has never had a bad knee. Before the war, he had two good ones. Afterward, he would never have to worry about his knees for the rest of his life. Chambliss ran one of the great attack ads of the 2002 cycle, one that warmed even Karl Rove's icy heart. It featured images of Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and Max Cleland. The ad savaged Cleland's votes against the president's, quote, vital homeland security efforts. The tagline, quote, Max Cleland says he has the courage to lead, but the record proves Max Cleland is just misleading. To recap quickly, Cleland loses three limbs in Vietnam. Cleland authors Department of Homeland Security legislation. Bush blocks it. Bush proposes politicized version of same legislation to trap Democrats. Cleland stands on principle and votes against it. Bush says senators not interested in security of American people. Chambliss compares Cleland to Osama and Saddam and attacks Cleland's courage. Chambliss wins. Republicans take Senate. Bush credits victory to change in tone. I grow discouraged.